in our studies for the past little while, we have entitled them, Welcome Back. Tonight, it's Welcome Back Part 3, and there's a reason for that. The reason for that has to do with the place that we are in our study. And I want to call your attention to two or three things before we get in actually to a study of the book of Esther in our study tonight. We've noted in Ezra chapter 1 and in verse 3 that the permission granted by the king, King Cyrus of the Medo-Persian Empire, to return to the land had been granted to everyone, but not everyone went back. We've noted that the northern 10 tribes had been scattered throughout the Assyrian Empire during the conquering of the northern 10 tribes, and the southern kingdom has been scattered in the kingdom of Babylon. Of great significance is this little pink dot on this map. Now, I know that some of you probably can't see that as well as you'd like, and I'd be happy to put this back up here sometime and let you come up and just look at it, because it's really important. During the reign of the king of Assyria and his conquering of the known world at the time, he began to expand his borders, and he came down and took the northern 10 tribes captive when the city of Samaria was taken in 722 B.C., Interestingly enough, the reason was their idolatry. But you recall that God had promised them that if you worship and remain faithful to me, then I'll be with you. But if you don't, I will take you out of this land. And that's what the northern 10 tribes had done. They had worshipped idols, and the king of Assyria, not one of the northern 10 tribe kings, had been faithful. Not one from the day of its beginning or the day of the division of the kingdom. Not one had been a servant of God. Every one of them had been idolatrous. But at the time in the southern kingdom was reigning King Hezekiah. And King Hezekiah was faithful to the Lord and dependent upon the Lord and confident in the Lord. And when the king of the Assyrian army sent message to him that you need to surrender, sending that message by his captain of his army, Sennacherib, he sent word to him that you do just well to surrender, because if you don't, I'm going to destroy you. And Hezekiah said, no, we're not going to be surrendering. Now, that's a very loose, mixed paraphrase, but I want to get to the point of this. What we learn is that Hezekiah prayed to God, and God delivered the southern kingdom, in fact, the city of Jerusalem in particular, delivered Jerusalem from the hand of the king of Assyria, because when his army got up to fight the next morning, 185,000 didn't wake up. And so he went back home and carried his folks with him. And his two sons killed him when he got back to the city of Nineveh and the idol's temple where he was worshiping the idol. Interestingly enough. But what we see on this map is the mass expanse of the Assyrian Empire and this one little dot on the globe that was being faithful to God, and how that the great and mighty Assyrian Empire with all his forces and army, he could not conquer the city of Jerusalem. But the same promise went to Jerusalem that had gone to the northern 10 tribes. If you worship and serve idols, then I will raise up an empire and they'll destroy you. And that's what happened here. This map shows no place for Jerusalem, no place for Judah, because the Babylonian king had conquered the Assyrian kingdom all the way down, you see, into the Sinai Peninsula, and had taken Judah captive as well. So Judah is not on this map. But we know that God had prophesied through the prophet Daniel. In Daniel chapter 2, we've been studying some of this in our Sunday morning Bible class of the book of Revelation. His prophecy involved a sequence of four kingdoms, at which time Christ would be sent into the world and he would establish his kingdom. And we know that was during the days of the fourth empire, identified in that sequence beginning with King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2. So we've got Daniel telling us about the king of Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar. And after him, there was another empire, the Medes and the Persians, which included Cyrus. And Isaiah had prophesied during this time, in fact, about 200 years before Cyrus was born, much less a king, before any such existence of the Medo-Persian Empire, and named Cyrus. And you can read that in the last few verses of Isaiah 44, first few verses of Isaiah 45, that Cyrus is named as to be the one that would sign a decree allowing these people to go home. And so it was. The Medes arose, and here's the Medo-Persian Empire, ruled over by Cyrus, the king of what was the Persian Empire. They joined forces then with the Medes. And he wrote this decree allowing whoever wanted to go home. Now, one of the things that we've noted is the Babylonian captivity would last 70 years. That was a prophecy of Jeremiah. And we've also noted that considering that some of those in the northern kingdom who had already been taken captive, they'd been away from home a long time. In fact, the first point on this chart is it's been almost 200 years since the first captives of the northern portion have been taken captive. And I've got on this chart the year 721. Depends on what source you read after. Some say 721, some say 722. But a year's difference here or there doesn't really make our point. What we want to see is that they've been in captivity for a very long time, almost 200 years from the northern portion of the kingdom. The most recent captives have been gone for 50 years, and they've decided that we're happy where we are. We've made our businesses. We're happy here. We're doing things that are providing for our family, and so we're just going to stay where we are. And so when we raise the question on how many went home, well, only about 50,000 of the Jews that had been scattered about the Babylonian Empire started to go home. And this is what we're reading in the early chapters of the book of Ezra. And we've talked about Sheshbazzar or Zerubbabel, some believe that to be the same man, who led many of these captives on their way home. Now, a lot of the valuable vessels that have been taken from the temple have been returned by Cyrus, and I think that's interesting just to note that the most valuable things, the gold and the silver and such things, had been treasured by the king, and now they're returned to these people. But Cyrus had admonished the remaining Jews to contribute to this work of going back and rebuilding. Going home and rebuilding the temple, rebuilding the walls, rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. So that's what we have. It was a great day of joy as they start. However, as we've noted in previous studies, it was not always a great day of joy, because when they got there, they found out that their land had not just been sitting idle. It was a wonderful land. We know that God enticed the people of Israel with the promise that I'm going to lead you into a land that flows with milk and honey. It was a great place to be. And so the Samaritans, the Ammonites, the Edomites, and the tribes of the desert, they moved into this very fertile land that had been once occupied by the Israelites. So when they come back, they find their people there that are not in such a hurry to just leave. And so we've got a little problem. They found there are enemies there. And in particular, the Samaritans. They believed, as we've discussed earlier, we'll not go into that, they think that they are servants of God too. And so when the Jews come back and want to rebuild, they say, let us help you rebuild. And of course, they were told, no, you're not a part of us. This is our job, and we'll not allow you to rebuild the temple with us. And you can see why the Samaritans' whole perception of God was skewed to the point of considering him just one of a number of idols that they continued to worship. So now we've got the people returning home under the leadership of Zerubbabel attempting to build the temple. And we're going to be studying in some detail from the book of Haggai what problems that presented just in the rebuilding of the temple. A part of Ezra's work was to reestablish the priesthood and began that. And we talked about that from Ezra chapter 3. Nehemiah, that whole book, discusses the rebuilding of the walls around the city of Jerusalem. And these enemies, even after the temple has been rebuilt, in 444 B.C., we find, 550 to 516, 520 to 516 B.C., the temple was built. And then the year 444 is when Nehemiah comes to rebuild the walls around the city of Jerusalem. These enemies don't just lay down. They still present problems. And so Nehemiah has to meet with that, and we'll talk about that in the book of Nehemiah in great detail. But it caused, because the Jews are trying to do this, we have a change now in the kings. What happened to Cyrus? Well, he died. His son has become king. And when his son becomes king, these enemies approach him and say, these people are bad people. You don't want them. Search the records. Find out how horrible these people are. You don't want them rebuilding in this land. And he searched the record, and what did he find out? Well, they were a rebellious people. And we know that that was one of the things that caused them to be taken captives in the beginning. And they were a rebellious people. And so Cambyses said, no, you're not going to be able to build the temple. He wrote a decree, can't do that. And then another decree was forthcoming from his son, Darius. And his son searched the records. And what did he find? He found, yes, these people are kind of a rebellious people and all of that, but my granddaddy wrote this decree to start with, King Cyrus, that these people were to be allowed to be rebuilt in the land, and so they're to be able to rebuild, and the people are supposed to supply the things that they need according to the decree of my granddaddy. Now again, that's mixed, very loose paraphrase, but that brings us to the point where the people are in the land trying to rebuild with the blessings of King Darius to reestablish the temple and reestablish those things that existed in the city of Jerusalem. Now, having said that, we might note just here that the people were very, very discouraged. There's a great work to do. Now, the point of this series of lessons, the point that I had in mind with it, was we're coming out from under a lot of restraints that have been imposed upon us because of the virus. Well, we get that. We're trying to learn to get along with the virus and get past the virus and go about our work, reminding ourselves that we have a great work to do. Just like they did. They had a great work to do. And Nehemiah in particular would not be deterred when a compromise offer was proposed to Nehemiah to meet with the enemies. He said, I can't be doing that. We're doing a great work. Now, brethren, the 5th Street East Church of Christ has a great work to do. A great work to do. And let us not be detoured by things round about us. Let us get on with our work. Our work is spreading the borders of the kingdom, teaching the people that are in this area, and we need to busy ourselves with that and focus upon each and every opportunity that we have. We don't know where it might come from, but we know what our job is, right? To rebuild, to arise and rebuild. That's what these people were attempting to do, and they met with opposition. I would dare say we'll meet with opposition. One of the greatest oppositions that Nehemiah met with is found in the 5th chapter of the book of Nehemiah, and that was internal strife. We don't want that. That was the one thing that brought the work to a stop. Out of all of the enemies that they had, they could not stop the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem, the rebuilding of the temple, the rebuilding of the walls, until internal problems began. Now, friend, you test the air to sense any kind of internal issues that need to be dealt with, because they need to be dealt with immediately. They'll stop the work of rebuilding. They did in the days of Nehemiah. We today need encouragement. Well, we find that this new letter has been sent out by King Darius instructing the people to build. And so the work goes on, and we see about that in Ezra chapter 6 going forward. Now, here's the problem. When the people first came back into the land, they were enthusiastic about laying the foundation to rebuild the temple. But 20 years has passed. They laid the foundation. And now, because of the opposition and the upset and the inquiries, the political environment and all of that, 20 long years has passed. What do you suppose 20 years would do to you? Look back and see what a year has done to you. Now, what would it do if you multiplied that times 20? You see what kind of circumstance has existed in the land? For 20 years, the building of the temple is just the foundation's there, but that's the end of it. Enthusiasm is gone. Now, when they begin to build the temple after the foundation was laid, now 20 years later or so forth, about 4 years it took to build the temple. Well, you say, well, that's not very long. No, it's not. It's a lot shorter than 20 years where it's laid in a dormant state. And it's because the people began to work, and they worked together, and they saw the urgency of the work that they had to do. Now, the book of Esther, I've wanted to study this with you at this point in our study, because it's right in here about chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra that the events that we're reading in the book of Esther take place. So it's timely for us to study the book of Esther and see what's happening at this particular point in the chronology of the history of Israel. I heard someone recently mention that every Bible student ought to be more than just a little bit familiar with Bible geography. I believe that's so. We need to be able to mention the city of Tyre, and you know right where it is on the map. Mention the city of Rome, we know right where that is on the map. Mention the island of Cyprus, we know right where that is on the map. And because these are Bible places that we study frequently, and we need to get a perspective in our mind for the location of where these are, but that's not the only thing that a good Bible student needs to have a real good grasp on. The other thing that I want to mention to you is chronology. We're studying in our class on Wednesday night the chronology of the life of Christ. And when you think chronology, you're trying to put events in somewhat of a sequence of the time when they happen. So you've got the events in order. Now, somebody might read from Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John and say, well, you know, some of these accounts, they record the events, but they don't seem to be in order. And that's true. That's absolutely true. And you need to note that some of the gospel accounts were not written to give you a chronological view of the events, but simply to record the events. And John is different from all of them. The purpose of John's writing is to record certain miracles that Jesus performed so that you will know He is the Christ. And John tells us that in John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. Now, 31 and 32. Now, the reason why I bring that to your attention is some of the New Testament books, such as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that describe the life of Christ, they're not written to be in chronological order of the events. Luke is. We'll call your attention to that. Luke is written, and Luke tells us that he is relating the things in order. You'll notice that in the very first chapter, in the beginning of that chapter. The things that Luke records are given in chronological order. And so when we get a timeline in our minds of when events happen, it's helpful to us to know what other events that are related to them occur and when, and what bearing then they have on these events. Do we not see that the place of Cyrus coming to be king, how significant that is on the timeline of the restoration of Israel? And then when we begin to read about Darius, the place on the timeline. And then we're going to be studying about Xerxes or a king named Artaxerxes in this sequence of studies. And what we're going to learn is that these kings have a place on the timeline. These are Persian kings. But some of the decisions that they made affected dramatically the people of God during this period of restoration or rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem. Now, one of the things that I like to study from the account of Esther is I use this lesson when we're talking about the providence of God. Now, I would call your attention to this passage in Esther chapter 4 as we introduce these things, reading beginning in verse 13. In Esther chapter 4, verse 13, it says, "Then Mordecai bade them return answer unto Esther, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then will relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house will perish, and who knoweth whether thou art not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." This is a fascinating question that's asked. Well, you say, well, why is that question asked? What's its relative nature to the context? I remember a lady that used to sit right here. Her name was Florence Patterson. You may remember Miss Florence. She was 87 years old when she obeyed the gospel. And Miss Florence was excited about Bible study. And the thing that impressed me the most was her enthusiasm about learning things that she had never studied before. And when we were studying, she said, "I don't know what the books of the Bible are about. I don't know if she'd ever read the Bible." And she said, "One of the things that I would like to do before I die is to have some kind of an understanding of what the books are about." Now, you can't go into a detailed study of every book. You don't have the time for that. So what do you do? We just very briefly paraphrase what the book is about. And so we looked at the book of Esther when we got to this, and in the chronology, we were describing what prompted the writing of this history. And what prompted the writing of this history is this king. His name was, and I will probably mispronounce it, Ahasuerus or Hazarus. And some say, well, this king was not a good king. No, he was not. He was not a good king. He engaged in a drunken feast with other kings. And in this drunken feast, he desired that his wife, Vashti, would come, who was very beautiful, by the way, and parade herself in front of all these other kings. Now, I've studied this lesson with some folks who said that, well, Vashti was just not being a good queen. She was not being a good wife. And so, consequently, what happened to her being rejected as queen was just punishment. Well, I want to call your attention to another thought. We note in verse 11, it tells us to bring Vashti, the queen, chapter 1, verse 11, before the king,
with the crown royal to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look upon. And do you suppose when Vashti comes before all these other kings, they're just going to look at her through some kind of a veil and see her eyeballs and admire her beauty? No, that's not the case. Vashti said, no, I won't do that. I won't do that. Well, what honorable woman would parade herself before a drunken group of men to display herself in the way that her husband evidently wanted her to do that? In verse 12 it says, but the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by the chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned within him. And his question was, what am I going to do with this queen? I've made a commandment and she won't respond. Now keep in mind the authority that a king had during this time, even his wife. If his wife didn't do what he said to do, he had the authority to kill her. If she approached him without order or without instructions or invitation, she was to be killed or could possibly be killed if he chose to do that. Now through the process of this, Vashti has refused to do what he's commanded her to do. And the king, Ahasuerus, is so much concerned that if this woman's reputation goes forward of rebelling against the king, then all the king's wives are going to do that. So what kind of influence am I going to have as king? I've got to make an example out of this woman. So he rejected her as being his queen. Now that's the long and the short of it. And so King Ahasuerus needs a new queen. And he begins, and I don't really like putting it in these terms, but that's the crux of it. He begins to take applications from all these women to become his queen. Now there were some requirements of becoming queen that I don't know the answers to. But I do know that young Esther, she becomes one in the line to be considered to be a queen. Now, that's one section of the story. A part, another segment of the story, is the king. The king had a right-hand man, and his name was Haman. Old Haman was a wicked old fella. And he didn't like the Jews. And you know why he didn't like the Jews? Because Esther's uncle, as most believe that it is, some think it was a cousin, but we'll, for our purposes, call him her uncle, named Mordecai. Haman was walking along, and as the king's right-hand man, Mordecai didn't give him the proper honor that he thought he should. And so he hated Mordecai. Mordecai was a Jew, of course. And because Mordecai didn't bow before him and give him the honor that he so desired, Haman approached the king. And he said, what I want you to do is write out a decree to kill all the Jews. Kill them all. The whole nation of them. Just kill them all. Now, the king did. He wrote out a decree. Kill all the Jews. He appointed the day when they were all to be slain. Now, can you imagine that? Put this on the calendar. I want to kill this nation on this day. That's what he did. Now, you know the consequence of that. If all the Jews have been slain, what about the promise made to Abraham? In thy seed, all families of the earth shall be blessed. Well, that's not going to happen. No. Not going to be any Christ coming through the lineage of Abraham if all the Jews are killed. Now, Mordecai tells Queen Esther, who eventually does become the queen, that you need to go before the king and beseech him on behalf of the nation of the Jews. Because who knows? But what you've been brought to this place for this cause. And when you talk about the providence of God, what we're reading about in this text or in the book of Esther is not the miraculous. It's not a miracle. But you see God on every page. I want to insist that you see that. God is on every page in the book of Esther, though His name is not mentioned once, not one time. But in the events of the chronology of sparing the Jews through Esther, and through this king, it was God that brought that about. Now we know that's so just by reading the book. Would encourage you to read this fascinating book. I was talking about Miss Florence Henderson. I almost got lost and forgot the point I was going to make. The book of Esther is such an exciting book. And she had not read it, not even been told the story of the book of Esther. We'd make a point and she'd sit on the edge of her seat and say, and then what happened? And most of you may remember the big beautiful smile that she had. And we'd get to a point and she'd say, and then what happened? Just as excited to be. And the book of Esther is that kind of book. Because we see God at work saving these people. During this time, in the history of the Persian Empire during this period of restoration. That's why we're studying this particular book, the book of Esther. Now, let me insist on saying this as well. When we talk about the providence of God, I can't always point my finger at this and say, God did this. This is something that God did. I get amused at people that do that. Well, this is the providence of God. Sometimes you might figure that. Sometimes you may figure that and be just as wrong as you can be. You'll notice the passages on the board, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 1. For all this I laid to my heart, even to explore all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. Now that we know is so. And you'll notice the next point being made in the third chapter, man cannot find out the work that God has done from the beginning even unto the end. You don't know everything that God's behind. And I would dare say that these Israelites who are being threatened by this king and through old wicked Haman, they may not know that God was behind all of this, but He was. He was. And He saved this multitude of people to do just the very thing that He had promised unto Abraham in Genesis chapter 22, in the first few verses of that chapter. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3, a number of times in the book of Genesis. Now, a reminder, in Deuteronomy 29:29, don't feel like, beloved brethren, that you have to know everything that God does, that you have to have the answer to every question. You know, sometimes folks ask a Bible question, and the proper answer to that is, I don't know. Now, it may be that you don't know because you haven't studied it. Well, just say, I don't know because I haven't studied it. But don't let it stop there. You get your head in the book and you study and maybe even find the answer. Now, after you've studied the book and you say, well, the answer's not in the Bible. Just God don't tell us. Be satisfied with that. Because Deuteronomy 29:29 tells us that the secret things belong to Jehovah our God, but the things that are revealed belong unto us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. The point being, the things that are revealed belong to you. The secret things don't. God hadn't told you everything. He's told you the things that He wants you to know that pertain to you. And they're recorded upon the pages of Scripture. And that's what it is to walk by faith, not by sight. You trust in what God has told you to do. You don't have to know all the whys and the reasons and dot all the I's and cross all the T's. If it says do this, then do this. Now that was a hard lesson for Habakkuk. We've talked about that. When Habakkuk was so concerned about the children of Israel, the things that they were doing, in particular the city of Jerusalem, the southern kingdom of Judah, the wickedness in which they engaged, he approached God with the question, how long are you going to put up with this? God said, I'll tell you, but you won't understand even if I tell you. And God told him, and Habakkuk just went ballistic. Well, they're worse than we are. Now again, that's mixed, very loose paraphrase. But you get the point. Habakkuk didn't understand why God would use them. And God told him, I'm going to destroy then the Chaldeans after I'm through using them to punish my people. And Habakkuk chapter 2, I believe it's about verse 2, is quoted with this statement that we must learn to walk by faith, not by sight. That the righteous walk by faith. It's quoted by Paul in Romans chapter 1 and in verse 17. We frequently quote verse 16, but verse 17 is to the point that we must accept this is what God said. And because God said it, this is what we do. Period. I don't have to dot all the I's and cross all the T's and get God to answer my every inquiry. And so it is with the book of Esther. We see the hand of God and the deliverance of these people. Now keep in mind, this king, who is also called Xerxes, or Ahasuerus in our text, he ruled over an empire made up of 127 provinces. The Jews were scattered throughout it as a result of this Babylonian captivity. And he was the reigning king of Persia, and you see the dates that we have on the board. And he had engaged in a number of wars, one unsuccessful war against Greece. And there's a good little bit of history regarding this man and his influence and relationship with other queens or other kings. But regarding Esther, this process of selecting a new queen, it took quite a little bit of time. And the bulk of the second chapter is about the selection of the new queen and the things that Esther did to become queen. It's important, I think, at this point to pause for just a moment and identify who Mordecai is and why Haman hated him. So, Mordecai is described as the king's gatekeeper. Now, that position was a very powerful and important position. It was Mordecai's responsibility to determine who got the presence of the king and who didn't. Kind of like our Secret Service, if you please. Mordecai had a very important job. He was the gatekeeper to the king, determining who was in the presence of the king and who was not. And you see that in chapter 2, verses 5 through verse 7. Now, when Haman came along, Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. Made Haman mad. That's simple, isn't it? Just made him mad because he wanted to be recognized. And Mordecai didn't recognize him. And so that created this plot to kill all of the Jews. Now, I want to pause again just a moment and read some, if you would please, in the second chapter. Let's pick it up at verse 19. In verse 19, it says, "And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai and was like a child." "Like as when she was brought up with him. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains," of course, we read what their names are, "they came before." And you'll note in verse 23, it says, "And when inquisition was made of the matter," now Mordecai finds out that some of these fellows are making a plot to kill the king. And when it was found out, he told the king what had taken place, got word to the king, and these men were hanged. And it was recorded in the Chronicles. Now you say, well, why is that important? It will be very important just a little bit in the study of this book. Now, in the third chapter, what we want to note is that Haman is identified who he was. He was the equivalent of what we would call the prime minister. He was a very important fellow to the king. And you see that in the third chapter. And because Mordecai didn't bow down before him, in the third chapter, beginning in verse 6, we see this plot laid. It says, "But he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had made known to him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, even the people of Mordecai." Now look again. We want to see that his plan is not just to hurt Mordecai. He wants to kill the whole nation of people. Everybody that is a Jew, he wants to kill them all. In verse 7 it says, "In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur," that is, the lot, "before Haman from day to day and from month to month, to the 12th month, which is the month Adar. And Haman said to the king Ahasuerus, 'There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of thy kingdom. And their laws are diverse from those of every people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver unto the hands of those that have the charge of the king's business to bring it unto the king's treasuries.' And the king took a ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammathita, the Haggite, the Jews' enemy. The king said to Haman, 'The silver is given to thee, the people also to do with them as it seems good to thee.'" Now look carefully. Giving him the king's ring is saying, go for it. That's what he's telling him. Go kill him. And they've cast lots. They've gambled to decide what kind of what day that they're going to do this. They're going to carry out this order and kill them all in one day. And money going to be paid to them to carry this out. Now in the third chapter, beginning in verse 13, it says, "And letters were sent by post to all the king's provinces to destroy, to slay, to cause to perish all Jews." Sounds like legal language, doesn't it? To destroy, to slay, to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even whereupon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. So they're not just going to kill them. They're going to take everything they've got and put that in the treasury. So, do we not see what's taking place here? Now, strangely enough, the king is in agreement with this. He believes what Haman, his right-hand man, has told him about all of this. Now, it's at this point that Mordecai instructs Esther, "You need to plead before the king on behalf of this, on behalf of the Jews, that he not do this." Now, what have we learned about the writing of the kings of Persia, their decrees? When they wrote a decree, when they signed it and it was sealed, it was not to be changed. Couldn't be undone. Now, there's a danger in that in and of itself. making a decree that no matter come what may, we can't undo this. We can't change our mind. We can't back up on it. It's just going to have to be carried out. Now, it would seem at this point that things are in really peril for the Jews. And all because of the hatred of one man, Haman. Now, brethren, we think that politics is something new. What generated all this? Mordecai didn't bow down before him. And so he hated him. And so what are we going to do? We're going to wipe out a whole nation because of this. We're going to kill them all. What foolishness. Now, it's at this point that Mordecai instructs Esther, you need to approach the king. Who knows? But what you've been brought to this place for this very purpose. Now, I want to call to your observation what else Mordecai told Esther. In verse 14, he said, for if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then will relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another source. And don't miss that. Yes, we know, and we emphasize the statement that who knows whether or not you may have been brought to this place for this time to free these people, to spare these people. But if you don't do this, Esther, then the people will be provided for. There will be another source. Now, what did Mordecai know? He knew what God had promised to Abraham long ago. There's going to be a Savior going to come through the lineage of Abraham. The Jews are not going to be destroyed. But now this is the decree. And this is how Mordecai sees this thing playing out. Esther, you may be brought to this very place for this time. Now, it's interesting, especially so, to note her response. Look at verse 15 of chapter 4. Then Esther bade them return answer to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and feast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, or 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast in like manner, and so will I go unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Now that's an attitude to have, isn't it? I'm going to do what I can do on behalf of my people. I'm going to approach the king on behalf of the people. And if I perish, I perish. Her concern is expressed in verse 11. If you're wondering, well, why is she concerned at all about approaching her husband? He was the king of the mightiest empire on earth. And he had the authority. If someone approached him without an invitation, if he did not then extend his scepter to them, which was an indication it's all right to approach me, they could be killed. Even if it was his wife, yes, even if it was his wife. And you see that in verse 11 and 12 of the fourth chapter. Now what's Esther willing to do? I'll approach the king. I'll approach the king on behalf of the people. And if he kills me, then I just die. If I perish, I perish. But I've got to do this. Now, what an interesting concept. So she decides what she's going to do and the circumstance and environment in which she's going to propose before the king this problem that involves the nation of the Jews. Now keep in mind, she's not revealed to the king that she herself is a Jew. So if this threat is carried out, this decree is carried out, then Esther's house would be killed too. So you see why she could say, if I perish, I perish. I'm going to perish anyway. So this is a one-shot thing. It's either good or bad, but if I live, I live. He'll respond favorably. If I die, I'm going to die anyway. Now, how admirable. If she dies because she is not invited by the king, then she would have died anyway because she is a Jew. This decree would be carried out. So she plans how she's going to arrange this thing to propose before the king that somehow this thing be rescinded. Now, as you turn in your Bible to the fifth chapter of the book of Esther, Esther appears before the king. She invites the king to a banquet. Let's pick up the thought beginning at verse 2 of chapter 5. It says, it was so when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court that she obtained favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. Then said the king to her, what wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given to thee unto half of the kingdom. Now that's quite generous. I'll give you what you want, up to half of the kingdom. And Esther said, if it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for them. Well, what a thing. Your invitation is to come to a feast? Yeah, that's what I want you to do, come to a feast. I want you to bring Haman. Bring him with you. Now, old Haman, he's just an interesting character. Look, beginning in verse 9 of this text. It said, then went Haman forth that day, joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai at the king's gate, he stood not up nor moved for him. He was filled with wrath against Mordecai. So he still don't like Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman refrained himself and went home and sent and fetched his friends and Sheresh, his wife. And Haman recounted unto them the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him and how he had advanced him above the princes and the servants of the king. And Haman said, moreover, yea, Esther, the queen, did let no man come in with the king unto the banquet that she had prepared, but me. What an arrogant fellow. The only one out of all the kingdom that got to come before the queen was the king and me. She didn't invite anybody else. Now in verse 13, it says, yet all this availeth me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then said Sheresh, his wife, and all his friends unto him, let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high. In the morning speak thou unto the king that Mordecai may be hanged thereon. And then go out and go thou in merrily with the king unto the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, and he caused the gallows to be made. Now, can you imagine how arrogant Haman is now? I'm going to get rid of Mordecai. I'm going to get rid of him myself. I'm going to order that this gallows be made, and I'm going to hang him. Be done with old Mordecai. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. Now, in the sixth chapter, those of you that knew Miss Florence, I'm sure that you can imagine her excitement just in the relating of the story of Esther, because it is an exciting bit of history in the account of this period of restoration history. They're coming back into the land. Now, in the sixth chapter, a little bitty detail, the king couldn't sleep one night. You ever have a night and you can't sleep? What do you do? Well, somebody says, I get up and I watch a movie on TV to get my mind off or something. Well, what if you didn't have TV? You might say, well, I get up and read a book. Interestingly enough, we think that the reading of a book might settle our minds and help us to fall asleep easier. That's not a new concept, because the king, he couldn't sleep. And he ordered that the king's chronicles, record of the chronicles, be brought to him. Now, what the kings did is they had things written down as a history of events when they were king. And so he begins to read the chronicles. He can't sleep. And what does he read? He begins to read about Mordecai. Mordecai. Way back yonder, Mordecai reported these two traitors. And they were taken out and hanged. And so Mordecai saved my life. These fellows were going to kill me. They were going to assassinate me. What was done to honor the dignity of Mordecai? An inquiry was made, and come to find out, there wasn't anything done for Mordecai. And who else to ask? The king brought in Haman, his right-hand man, and said, if you really wanted to honor somebody, what would you do for him? What arrogance. Haman thought, well, he's got to be talking about me. So what could be the grandest honor that I could possibly imagine that the king of the greatest empire in the world could bestow upon me? And so Haman's request is revealed beginning in verse 6. Chapter 6, verse 6. So Haman came in, and the king said unto him, what shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now Haman said in his heart, to whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delighteth to honor, let royal apparel be brought, which the king used to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and on the head of which a crown royal is set. And let the apparel and the horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man therewith whom the king delighteth to honor. and cause him to ride on horseback through the street of the city and proclaim before him, thus shall be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Now can't you just picture old Haman seeing himself riding that horse, wearing the king's clothes and wearing the king's crown, being led around by one of the most honored men in the king's court? Well, he thought that was going to be the way that it would be played out, but it wasn't played out that way. Beginning in verse 10, he said, that's a good idea. Now again, that's mixed loose paraphrase. Let's read what it says. Verse 10 of chapter 6. Then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse, and as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai. Can you see old Haman's just smoke coming out of his ears? Do that to Mordecai, the Jew that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. Then took Haman the apparel, the horse, and arrayed Mordecai, and caused him to ride through the street of the city, and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Old Haman, he thought he was going to be on that horse, and here he is leading around old Mordecai. Man, he hates. In verse 13, it says, and Haman recounted to Sheresh his wife and all his friends everything that had befallen him. Then said his wise men and Sheresh his wife to him, if Mordecai, before whom thou hast begun to fall, be the seed of the Jews, thou shalt not prevail against him, but shalt surely fall before him. While they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Now we've got a second banquet here that's coming up. Haman's invited to that too. And the king is invited to that. So Haman and the king come into Esther's for dinner. And the king, in chapter 7, said to Esther, what is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. What is thy request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be performed. Then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my peace, although the adversary could not have compensated for the king's damage. Then spake King Ahasuerus and said unto Esther the queen, who is he and where is he that doth presume in his heart to do so? Well, that would be Haman. Now you picture that scene. Haman and all of his arrogancy with the king, before the queen, at this great banquet. And Esther now has prepared two banquets. And in preparing these two banquets, we find that she identifies Haman to her husband as being the bad guy. It's him that's doing all this. Well, the next few verses are quite fascinating. Look, if you will, at verse 6. Esther said, an adversary, an enemy, even this wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went to the palace garden. And Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther, the queen. For he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. Now, wouldn't you be pleading for your life? In all of his arrogancy, he thinks all of this reward is going to be his. He's going to get his way and Mordecai is going to be dead. All the Jews are going to be killed. And now the king finds out that he is the one who has laid this plot. And then in verse 8, then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine, and Haman was fallen upon the couch whereon Esther was. Then said the king, will he even force the queen before me in the house? Now you see the impression that the king has gotten from Haman. The queen decked out over here on this couch, and Haman's all over her couch. That don't look right, does it? The king come in and he said, what are you doing? And if you'll read further just a little bit, in verse 9, it said, then said Habonah, one of the chamberlains that were before the king, behold also the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman hath made for Mordecai, who spake good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. And the king said, hang him thereon. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified.
Now, do you find that to be a kind of strange twist in the history? Haman is hanged on the gallows that he had intended for Mordecai. Well, his wife and his near friends had told him, don't be messing with this. No good can come out of this. And as they had warned him, no good came out of this. And so we learn then that Haman was hanged on his own gallows. Now that raises the question, what happened to the Jews? In the 8th chapter, in verses 1 and 2, we learn that the position that Haman had had, now Mordecai has that position. He's right-hand man in the whole kingdom. Mordecai, given that position. You say, well, what about the decree that the king has signed? Well, because of Esther's pleading on behalf of the people of the Jews and risking her own life to do so, the king sends out a new decree. And this is in chapter 8, if you'll note, beginning in verse 8 through verse 10. It says, write ye also to the Jews, as it pleaseth you, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's ring may no man reverse. Well, now, what does this decree say? This decree is sent out very simply throughout all the 127 provinces that the Jews may arm themselves on this day and defend themselves against those who would be intent on killing them. Now, what's happened? Well, instead of a bunch of defenseless Jews being slaughtered, now we have folks intent on slaughtering them, but they're not defenseless anymore. They're told about what's about to happen, and they can take up swords and defend themselves. And if you remember, the Jews were not bad at that. They knew how to do that. And they did. They defended themselves. And you can read about that in chapter 8, verses 11 through 17. And because they defended themselves, and old wicked Haman now having been slain, and Mordecai put at the top of the list of the king's important men, the people of the Jews, they are spared. And just to make sure that nobody of Haman's descent became angry and tried this again, we find that it was ordered that all 10 of Haman's sons be slain too. You see, sometimes our wicked motives and wicked intentions have terrible consequences. Haman got himself killed and all of his sons because of his intent to destroy the Jews because of his hatred for Mordecai. Now, beginning in verse 13 of chapter 9, it said, then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews that are in Shushan to do tomorrow according to this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows. And it was so. 75,000 Persians were killed, enough to deliver the Jews. And so it was a great day of joy among the Jews as they were spared. Now, if you'll note, beginning in verse 20 of chapter 9, it says, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, both nigh and far, to enjoin them that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same yearly as the days wherein the Jews had rest from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to gladness and from mourning unto a good day. That day, instead of being a day of slaughter, was now a day of celebration, to be celebrated every year, because now the Jews have been spared. Now, if you'll drop down to verse 26, you'll see what these days were called. It says, wherefore they called these days Purim, after the name Pur. It became a national holiday among the Jews because the nation of the Jews were spared. Now, having read that, you'll look down in the last verse of chapter 10. The last verse, verse 3 of chapter 10. It says, for Mordecai the Jew was next unto King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed. Mordecai was a good guy. He helped the people in this way. And because of him and because of Esther, the people were spared. Now note, again, Mordecai's confidence in the fourth chapter, if not this way, then perhaps some other way. But it's going to be accomplished. Now, we raise the question, God's name not in the book of Esther at all, but you see him on every page. How did Mordecai happen to be even alive at the time to be appointed as prime minister? Well, we see it was because of the providence, if you please, of God. And how come the king had trouble sleeping that night? And when he had trouble sleeping, why did he ask for the chronicles to be brought, the history? And how did the king just happen to hear about Mordecai saving his life, just happen to read that section of the chronicles? And how did it happen that until now the good deed of Mordecai has somehow been overlooked? He hasn't yet been rewarded. And how did the young queen Esther, how did she become an orphan to begin with and go from being an orphan raised by her uncle to become queen over a world empire? How did all that transpire? You see, though God's name is not in the book at all, he's scattered throughout it, isn't he? And the Jews were spared. God brought this about. And Mordecai believed in that. And we see that in Esther chapter 4, verses 13 and 14. Now, be reminded, we don't always know of the providence of God, but you can't help but see it in the life of Esther, can you? Through the providence of God, on every page, the nation of the Jews were spared. Don't always know when God's hand is active, don't always know the specifics of all of that. But what we do know is that the wise, the righteous, and the wise and their works are always in the hand of God. Now be that the lesson. You've listened patiently to a very important segment, I believe, of the history of the restoration period. And you see the attitudes that were prevailing during this very significant time in their history that spared these people and brought about the work that God intended for them to do. You've got the reins there, Richard. So you can get that going when you want to. I want to note, however, as we close, that this is an opportunity, as any time that we come together or any time that you determine, I want to be a Christian. I want to obey the gospel. I believe that Jesus is, in fact, the Son of God. The evidence doesn't commit to anything else. He is the Son of God. It's my desire to turn my life around. I don't want to continue a path of sin. I want to change, stop doing the bad things and begin doing the good things that God wants me to do. The Bible calls that repentance, and it's a very crucial, important step in obedience to the gospel. Think about that hard. Then confess your faith and be baptized. Baptism, as we discussed this morning, is the purpose to set us apart, wash away our sins, so that we can be identified as a child of God. That makes you a Christian. You see, you're a child of God. You're a Christian. Maybe as a Christian, you're not living the kind of life you know you should. Why not correct that tonight? We can pray with you and for you. It'd be our desire and delight to do that, to help you to stand right as you walk the kind of life that God wants you to walk. If you be subject to the invitation, make it known by coming to the front as we stand and sing this song.